This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome to You're Making It Worse. I'm Elliot Glazer.
I'm Brent Sullivan.
And I'm H. Allen Scott.
We're here. We're queer.
Meh.
Textual healing.
So, you guys probably saw this in the news this week. Greece's parliament voted on Thursday to extend equal marriage and automatic parental rights to all of the country's 10.5 million citizens and to allow same-sex couples to adopt.
Well, I'm not going to Greece
now. Your ancestry,
right?
Your Greek ancestry.
That is correct.
To be honored.
Ancestry. Now, this might seem like a no-brainer because Western Europe has been in support of gay marriage for ages, but Greece is the first majority Christian Orthodox country to take this step. This is funny. I grew up, my mom would talk about, my parents, as we've discussed many times, are not religious at all, but my mom, we would still celebrate holidays, in particular Easter, we would celebrate it with the Greek Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, I don't know what the fuck that is. I don't know what Greek Orthodox is. I just assumed it was some sort of like subsect of a Jesus thing. And then I subsequently, you know, over time, you know, I think it was when I moved to New York, I would walk around and you would see Russian Orthodox churches and like Bulgarian Orthodox churches. And you're like, what is this Orthodox thing? And so I did a little bit of research about the difference between the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church. And it turns out it's actually very boring and I won't get into it. That said, the Orthodox Church is just generally associated with more conservative parts of the world currently.
Well, what did it look like at your house? Like, what does that look like in the Sullivan home?
It was literally a week. It was just, we celebrated Easter 1 week later because Greek Easter was always like a week after regular Easter.
Were there activities? And was there a roast of some kind?
My mom would always make a leg of lamb for Easter. Yep.
I love it.
Leg of lamb. And we actually make that for Christmas now. That's like
Elliot got Christmas super
dinner.
Excited about that leg of
lamb. I love the idea of Brent being like in an ethnic home, like having to live through some sort of like ethnic flair. I love that. I don't know why. I love him having to.
Well,
but
my mom has a lot of Greek pride. She has a lot.
Yeah.
And I have very, very little.
I know. And I've always historically been like, Brent, embrace it. It's so.
Yeah.
Yeah. The food, the culture. It's so exciting.
I have actually started making some of her Greek dishes. And
like what kind of dishes?
Well, it's called spanakopita.
Yeah.
She calls it budekia. I make some rice she made. I make some a chicken recipe.
Yum.
And I make her Greek rice pudding.
Ooh. What makes it different from the other rice pudding?
I don't know. It's actually very simple. And I sort of describe it as like, you know, horchata.
Yeah.
It's basically like a meal version of horchata.
Oh.
But I make it every once in a while. It's just
I love a Greek pastry.
Rice, milk and sugar.
I love like desserts. Greek desserts and pastries and like just
incredible
Greek sweets are just so delicious.
Well, this is why I've invited Brent in particular to the Greek festival in Long Beach.
It's
it's wonderful. It's wonderful. The food is wonderful.
It's super annoying.
It's at a church and it's.
I mean, I like it. I liked it for the food and stuff, but I was just sort of like, this is too much. I gotta go.
I love the dancing and the food and the family element. I love it.
There is, I can't help it. There is something about whenever. I'm going to say, I guess, ethnic in quotes, because, you know, it could be quite literally any, you know, any sort of first generation family. whenever I see them celebrating sort of their heritage, I think it always looks so dumb. I feel bad saying that, but I do. I can't help it. There's this guy I follow on Instagram who's always posting like him like dancing and like weddings with his family, and they look so
ridiculous. I'm with you because there is something, and I'll say this about Jews too. I'll say this about Christians and like other ones that like have these ceremonies, these things where everyone is supposed to participate and dance and be merry and like go around in a circle and hold hands and all it's what our friend Brandy calls forced merriment. And I hate it. I want to be the hateful person sitting at a table, drinking wine and eating the dessert and saying, please go dance in a circle. I don't give a fuck, but don't drag me into that fucking circle. I don't want it.
To be fair, Judaism is the fun exception because we embrace the misery of it all. And I don't think we shy away from the sort of, you know, the neuroses and the
self-loathing. I've been to many a Jewish event where I've been dragged into something where I'm just like, can I just go complain in the corner?
Oh, that's every Jewish event.
You can complain.
Of course, but there's also like the oh, you're a happy person. Come dance in this circle and let's hold hands and sing this song.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
yeah, there's always hand holding.
And yes, that's West Coast Judaism. And there are people complaining in the corner. You're right, but what I'm saying is, it's the dragging, it's the forced merriment of the thing. And I
forced
just want to be in the corner.
I understand. Yeah. Well, so wait now. Do you have family members on your mom's side who were also Orthodox?
No, I know that my grandmother, Yaya, which we call her Yaya. I know Yaya went to church, but I don't think I know my mom's brother does not go to church. I think dumb bitch Ramona probably, I know she has like basic religious beliefs, but I don't think she goes to a Greek Orthodox church.
Hmm.
But I know she's like basically Christian, I think.
But it's still a big deal for this to happen in Greece, I guess.
Yeah, it was a big deal. Let me go back to the
Mykonos
isn't this also
one of
where the guy's gonna create the new Fire Island too? We talked about last week. Also in Greece?
Yeah,
somewhere.
That dipshit from last week. Yeah. He wanted to make a new Fire Island. So the interesting thing, and we'll get into this real quick. The prime minister, who pursued this measure, ran on a platform of legalizing gay marriage. It's widely accepted amongst the constituency. However, he comes from a conservative party in the country, and he actually struggled to build a coalition to support. To support this gay marriage, bill, and it's just kind of interesting to think that, like, boy, wouldn't it be nice if we had a Republican Party, a conservative party that was a little bit more open. Although, to be fair, we did pass a gay marriage bill earlier in 2023, and there were a few Republicans who supported that. So there you go. It's always good.
Wow.
Okay. Bye.
More importantly, have you gone to Greece?
I have never been to Greece, never once.
You should go and reconnect with your roots.
I'm dying.
Oh my God,
no,
go!
No. I don't know. I don't think my mom had even.
Don't
been
go to you want you go to Boise. You want to go to Branson, Missouri. go to Greece. Reconnect with your roots. You know, like you don't have to go to Mykonos
go
to a circuit
roots.
Party.
It's not my roots. My grandmother was born in Athens, probably 100 years ago now, but that's it. You know, that's the only, that's the only connection I feel with Greece. However, I have been saving a lot of money to return to my roots, and I'm flying back to Michigan, and I'm going to be staying in Flint. I'm going to be staying in Kalamazoo. I'm going to be spending a week in the suburbs of Detroit just to kind of, again, experience the beauty that is Michigan.
Wow.
Boring. Wow. Boring. Go to Greece.
Wow.
Not even joking.
Well, we are here with my dear friend, Kate Stamen London. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Elliot.
What a fantastic
name. It's been a long time coming.
Kate Stamen London. You sound like a, it almost sounds like a morning news anchor sort of name. You know what I mean?
You know, it gets even better. It's actually Catherine Ellen Stamen
London.
Wow. So we're really, if you want to run out of space on a standardized test, I have a lot of ways for you to do that.
I still remember, I just want to throw, there was a girl I went to school with in high school who had four names.
Oh, do you remember them?
Yes, of course. Carmen Andrea Ortiz Tello, and she insisted wow. You call her Carmen Andrea. I was like, no, I'm going to call you one or the other.
I've never insisted on being called Catherine Ellen, but maybe I should try it.
You should.
Spice it up a little bit.
But I really want you to like do a CBS Mornings moment, being like, it's 7:55. This is Kate.
It's 7:55. If I'm awake right now, it's not by choice. This is Kate Stamen London bringing your morning.
Now, Kate and I met writing on iCarly. Lived through that together.
We sure did.
But Kate is also an author, a speechwriter, a political activist, and I guess you would say strategist, right?
Yeah, that feels like the catch-all way we talk about stuff I've done.
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. You've done a little bit of everything. I will say my favorite thing about you is your relationship with your mother, in which she dressed you the way she dressed you as a child, and why, if you don't mind
sure
explaining.
So my mom is gay, and I think had, you know, she's what we would sort of refer to as butch, but she certainly had some gender expression issues and was married to my father, a straight man. They did meet playing softball. She did wear a blazer to the wedding.
She wore a blazer to the wedding.
She sure did. And she did dress me as a boy for my first couple of years of life. And I really rebelled against that and was just now being like, ooh, should I wear the pink scarf? Then do I need to do a pink lip to match? So I think my sort of like deeply feminine expression is against sort of the way
I am.
I was
still just
child.
Obsessed with your mother wearing a blazer to her wedding. How Cynthia Nixon of her.
We call it Poundstone. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, Kate's childhood pictures from that those couple of years are, I feel bad because like when you've shown them to me, I can't, they're hysterical.
They're like, I mean, the hair in the first place is awful. Like if a little boy had that hair, you'd be like, that's terrible. Like a little girl, you're like, that's not the way we usually traditionally think of gender expression, and certainly not the way we thought of it in 1983. And it wasn't great. But you know, she was a dapper little gentleman.
Wait, where were you raised?
New York City and Montclair, New Jersey.
Oh, so where lesbians thrive then? Yeah.
Yes, that's okay. Right. Mm-hmm. That's your mom right. Was. Although I think you can put us just about anywhere, and we'll do fine.
I've even heard about lesbians on the Antarctic. So truly, they are everywhere these
days. Well, Jodie Foster did the Future Detective, and that's somewhere near the Antarctic.
That's right. I think it's northern. So when did your mom come out then? Or is she still married to that guy?
That guy, my dad.
Her dad?
That guy, your dad.
No, she came out to me when I was 15. And at that time, she had been with her partner, who's still her partner, for 5 years. And so that was when I learned that mom's best friend, Liz, was actually more than mom's gal pal, Liz. Yeah, and they've been together ever since.
Did you have any idea before she told you?
I did not.
Wow.
I really didn't.
And how did you take it? Like, what was that like?
It was fine. Yeah. I was
hoping you'd be really bigoted about it, but yes, go ahead. I'm glad it was fine.
I was very surprised, and I think it was more hurt that she hadn't told me than I was that she was gay. And of course I was, you know, sort of dealing with my own sexuality stuff, which I hadn't told her about yet. And so it was like, okay, well, I knew other gay people. It wasn't a big deal. You know, Montclair, New Jersey is like one of the liberalist towns in the country. Yeah. So it just wasn't a problem from that standpoint. And it was more like, oh, wow, this person that I've known as one thing for 5 years is actually someone different in your life, and I didn't know. But then, you know, sort of once you know, you figure it out, and it's not a big deal. Yeah.
This is a fairly consistent theme that we've discussed on the podcast, but it's something that I struggled with when I came out, and I think I would probably struggle with even more if a parent came out, which is I don't have that kind of relationship with my family. And so the acknowledgement of being gay has never been problematic. It's the acknowledgement of sexuality. It's the acknowledgement of horniness and sexual interest and
totally. And I will say, as a romance novelist, this is not a problem in my family.
Right. And as a Jew, I have to say there's no boundaries in my family. God. So absolutely nothing goes unsaid. So when you say, I'm sorry, I have to ask Brent, when you say that you couldn't talk about it, it's like, do your family acknowledges that, like, sex and romance exists, right?
I mean, 100%. It's just, but we didn't have that. And I think a lot of people don't have this kind of relationship with their parents, but we didn't have that kind of relationship where you chatted with your mom about crushes. Well, like, I never had that.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I never did that either. But to me, what's interesting about it is the equation of sexuality to sex. Well, yes, I get there is clearly a through lane there, but to me, it's so much more than that. It's so much more like the declaration of your sexuality actually to me has very little to do with the act of sex. It's not like I'm being like, mom, I'm gay, let's talk about buttholes. Like, I'm like, mom, I'm gay, this is my identity, I'm never gonna talk to you about buttholes though, don't worry. Like, that's sort of where that's my take on it, you know.
No, I hear you, but it's barely my identity. Yeah, so not a whole lot changed when I came out. I guess to me it all does kind of boil down to the sexuality element, but I definitely hear where you're coming from.
Yeah, that's wild.
So I mean, Kate, there's a lot to talk about with you because of our work experience, but I think, you know, Alan, you and Alan both share a commonality in that you both worked for Hillary Clinton.
What? I didn't know that.
Many years before you, because I was in her Senate office. But yes, wow. Yes,
Senator Clinton.
Yeah, I was a Senator Clinton person for a brief time, and then I went to work for Anthony Weiner. Awkward. Mm-hmm.
I know his ex.
Well, I know his ex too.
I know
his ex very well as well. Yes. Now, did you know Sarah Hurwitz, who did Michelle Obama's speech writing? Because I'm good friends with her. I figured.
No, okay. I didn't.
Yeah, that's different.
Well, actually, can I ask you, Kate, how did you get into speech writing? Because it's always something that I thought would be really fun, but I don't even have any idea how to start down that road.
So it wasn't, and I wasn't too, I was on the digital team on the 2016 campaign. So I was the lead writer for the digital campaign. So basically I was doing, and it's like, basically digital used to be much more siloed off from other parts of the campaign, but now, like, look at 2020, right? Yeah. Everything is digital, right? So I was the one writing the videos that the people were in, but that isn't that different from speech writing anyway. Yeah, sure. That's probably boring. But so I started my career working for the labor movement. I worked for the letter carriers, which is your mailman's union. And if you are wondering how to spend your early 20s, I can recommend getting drunk with mailmen in the Midwest. It's a really great way to spend your early 20s, in my experience. And then I wanted to move to California. I wanted to go to graduate school for screenwriting. And an old friend of mine was working for change.org at that time. And at that time, they did work that was more meaningful and relevant, perhaps, than the work that is happening now. And he asked me if I wanted to come and write for them part-time, sort of while I was doing the screenwriting thing. And I said, great. And then a colleague who I knew through that work, she was hired to run Hillary's digital team, and she said, Kate, come write for the campaign. And I, of course, said, no, absolutely not. Yeah. I'm not going to move to Brooklyn and be broke and give up my whole life. And she was like, you know, we're old friends, have a couple phone calls. And so, of course, 2 weeks later, I did quit my job and move to Brooklyn and give
and
up
I
my
also,
whole life.
I also think it's important for people to remember historically the digital space in which Hillary existed at that time, because before she even announced she was doing the campaign, there was the Ready for Hillary campaign, and there was that whole digital movement of people. I was part of that movement of people with bumper stickers saying ready for Hillary and sort of having that sort of anticipation of Hillary running. And so her digital side was incredibly important in 2016.
Thank you for saying so. And it was, you know, I remain incredibly close friends with, you know, it was some of the smartest, most exciting people I've ever worked with was during that campaign. And just, you know, you're really in the trenches together. We were together, you know, from 8 or 9 a.m. until midnight, pretty much 7 days a week for 2 years. And it's like, it's like being on a writing staff, but with the like fate of democracy.
Yeah.
Like sort of tied into it. I guess Elliot knows there would be times on iCarly when things were really, you know, going off the rails and we would have to rewrite a whole script the day before we were shooting or whatever. And people were like, this is crazy. And it's like, guys, no matter what happens, it's going to be an episode of iCarly. Donald Trump isn't going to be president at the end of this. Like, we're going to make it. It's going to be all right.
Do you have that now where like, I mean, even like, because I even have this too sometimes. I mean, I know I'm biased because I love Hillary and I'm always been a big supporter of hers. But like that sometimes I'll even look at, I mean, of course at Trump, but look at Biden and be like, this could have been Hillary's second term, the end of it or something. You know what I mean? This could have been, and we wouldn't be having this old conversation, or we wouldn't be having this conversation, or we wouldn't be having these things. And I sometimes have that thought of like, things could have been a hell of a lot better. But then again, people who hate her say the opposite. So who knows?
I mean, well, so when you said you worked for her in the Senate, one of my favorite stories about her is when she first started in the Senate. And so I guess the state delegation, the New York delegation, both the House and the Senate, they get together once a month to sort of talk about what's going on in New York State. And so when this was in 2016 and a few of the local reps from the New York City congressional delegation came by the office to talk to us. And they were saying, you know, the senators rarely show up for these meetings. It's usually just the people from the House. And when Hillary was elected, they were like, former first lady, super famous. There is no way she is showing up to this meeting. And of course, not only did she show up to the meeting, she had an entire binder from the research and the listening tour she had done on her campaign and wanted to hear from everybody else and let them take the lead. And how can she help? And that to me is so emblematic of the sort of person I learned of her first and then knew her to be, you know, the sort of person she would write personal thank you emails to staff for doing our jobs. And just like, you know, when she would meet someone on a rope line who was having trouble getting their uncle's cancer treatment covered, she would say, let's get their names. Let's follow up. Let's figure out what we can do. That was just, you know, kind of person.
When we're done recording, I have a story for you that I don't want to say. I don't want to say on the record, but I do want to tell you because you'll absolutely
love
it.
That's a
oh my God.
Really, really redeeming story. I wonder why Susan Sarandon still hates Hillary. But anyway.
By the way, if you ever want to really piss off someone who worked for Hillary in 2016, you need merely utter the word Susan Sarandon and you can really send someone into a tailspin.
I didn't even work for Hillary and I still never watched that fucking bitch on TV. But whatever the fuck she makes, I don't know. She's a ghoul. I'm over it.
I'm like, you really had to take Bull Durham from me, Susan. You had to do me like this. Come on.
You had one stepmom.
Wait. I want to go back to drinking with postal workers, though, because
first of all, I have to interrupt you and say, not postal workers, letter carriers. There are 7 different postal unions, and if you'd ever like to be very bored at a party, you can ask me about the difference between all of them. I can tell you.
Wow. Yeah. So I remember having this conversation with a friend many years ago. We had just moved to New York, and of course, we're looking for, you know, day jobs that allow us to pursue comedy and stuff. And my friend was like, I think I'm going to try to become a letter carrier. And I was like, yeah, that actually sounds great. I've always sort of secretly thought it sounds like a fantastic job. And he looked into it and he was like, it is way harder than you think.
To become one?
To become one. It's a long process. I actually think the Seinfeld joke with that with Wayne Knight was like, with Newman, was actually somewhat like close to the reality, which is like you work for years to get certain, to become a letter carrier, and then you get crappy routes, and then you aspire to get better routes, and all this shit. But yeah, what was your experience like with it?
Oh my gosh. Well, we're digging deep in the archives here. So, I mean, it was fantastic. So I was, the way that union worked, they have sort of young field reps for 5 regions, and my region was the Midwest. And so I spent 2 years sort of traveling around the Midwest and going to different conventions, I was pretty much always the only woman under 30 in any room I walked into, which was just wild. And also right before I had had that job, I was an intern at the Human Rights Campaign for the Coming Out Project. So it was quite a 180 going from the professional gaze to the letter carriers. I remember even coming out at that job was a big deal at that time. Oh, like it was, dude. I was like, I'm bisexual. And they were like, explain more. It wasn't even this was 2005. It wasn't that long ago, but it was a tough time. But, I loved the people I met, and especially the chairs of the state organization. So the Wisconsin state chair, right? These people would know their senators and representatives in DC by first name. And it was really cool just to see sort of working people who hadn't necessarily gone to college, but who were super smart, super passionate and dedicated to sort of helping their fellow letter carriers and doing that advocacy work and see that they had real power and real access in a way that, I don't necessarily think most people who don't have experience with unions would understand that union members have. And I have to say, so I'm a captain in the Writers Guild. I was the captain for iCarly. And my early experience with the letter carriers and seeing sort of the way they worked for each other really sort of stuck with me and was so moving to sort of be able to, years later become a union member and a captain in my union. And then of course with the strike last year, sort of really see those same principles in action.
Unions are the best. Yeah.
Unions rule,
man. They really do. I need to ask you though about being a romance novelist because
don't you see? Don't these all make sense together?
They do.
I think it's a cohesive picture we're painting.
But what I love about
it is
it all started with being dressed as a boy. I'm so sorry. I cut you
off. You're fine. No, what I love about it is because I'm a big reader. Brent loves to make fun of me because I used to read in New York City. I brought a book to a bar once and he hasn't lost the joke
once.
It's
a good one. It's a good
sure.
one.
You wrote a book called One to Watch about a plus size blogger asked to star on a bachelorette reality show. And one thing I wanted to say is that there is such size discrimination in literature, particularly romance literature, but also I'm thinking with the exception of maybe Jennifer Weiner, there's not many sort of really true. I mean, sure, there's Bridget Jones, but even she wasn't even written as plus size in that way necessarily. So there's such a lack of size diversity in romance, rom-com fiction that I love that you did that. And you paired it with something that was a mainstay show that everyone knows. You know what I mean? That's a vibe that is really, really cool. And I just want to commend you for that because it doesn't happen.
Oh gosh,
it doesn't
thank
happen
you so
often.
Much. Well, I'll say it's much better now than it used to be. And I'm far from a trailblazer in that area. And I would say if you're a reader who's interested in plus-size heroines in the rom-com space, that Talia Hibber and Olivia Dade and Julie Murphy, there are a lot of really terrific authors out there doing the work. And of course, Jennifer Weiner, which reading Good and Bad was a really seminal experience for me.
In Her Shoes, my God.
That is such a good movie. Didn't that movie come out on 9/11? Yes. Out on 9/11?
No, that was Glitter. That was Glitter, I think.
Macy Gray's album. That was Macy Gray's album.
Is so good. I remember not long ago, I was I put on movies to fall asleep to and I put it in Her Shoes and I became so riveted by it. I'd seen it before, but I was so riveted by it that I was up until 5 a.m. watching it because I'm just obsessed with it. It's such a good movie.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it's really good.
But it was when it, I've had a book agent for a long time and sort of after 2016 that I came back to LA and was trying to figure out what am I going to write? What am I going to do? And we were kind of batting back and forth. Originally, I had thought I'm going to write a sort of Bridget Jones on the campaign trail political rom-com. And then I don't know if you guys can imagine or understand this, but after the 2016 election, I didn't want to do that. So we were all right, well, what now? And I tried a bunch of different things and just nothing was making me happy, which it was early 2017, nothing was making anyone happy. And then I was I was just sitting on the couch watching The Bachelor. And I was what if The Bachelorette was fat? And it was literally just that, right? And I couldn't get the idea out of my head. And I stayed up until 2 in the morning, just writing just a little pitch. And I sent it to my agent. She was this is the one, go, right? And it was just it was just fun. And of course, the more I got into it, the more I was like, oh, this is also like serious, because what is it like? And it was actually working for Hillary really informed the way I thought about being a woman in the public space, and this idea that total strangers feel like they have ownership over you, and that the way they can exert that ownership most powerfully is to comment on your appearance. And the way that particularly this idea that if you're fat, it's this strike against you that you can never overcome no matter what. And of course, it isn't, right? Like, there's no, because there's no winning. It's not like thin women have it easy in the public space, because the point is the idea that anyone has ownership over women in the first place, right? So the more I got into it, the more I was like, oh, this is actually like a really, a thing that is really capturing my attention and my imagination. I'm excited to write about it. But then also I get to write a love story where the protagonist has like 20 love interests. So that was fun too.
So, you know, as someone who has not read a romance novel in his life, what, like, do you mind me asking, or
Brent,
perhaps
you're missing out, man.
You are.
I don't disagree.
There are a lot of excellent gay rom-coms too, I have to say.
I believe it. Elliot has a whole bookshelf that he'd be happy to loan me. But what, like, what is a sex scene like in a romance novel? Is it, I have no idea. What's it like? Tell some of our listeners who haven't read these romance novels.
So there's a whole spectrum, right? And I would say I'm probably on the much milder end of the spectrum. Like, One to Watch barely had any description of anything too specific, and was nevertheless mortifying to know that everyone in my family was reading. My next novel, which comes out this fall, is again on the mild end of things, but slightly more specific. And I'm already like, oh, we got to get a redacted copy for my dad. I don't know what we're going to do. Rob Stamen, I'm so sorry, Dad. I love you so much. I'm so sorry. But there are also, like, right now, this book, Fourth Wing, which is the dragon sex book, as I refer to it colloquially, is like this giant bestseller, right? Like, biggest book of 2023. And that is like, if you were just writing down what happened in porn, that is what is going on in this book. Like, it is just deeply specific, beat by beat, stroke by stroke. Here's what's going on when these two people have sex. So I think, you know, it really, and then you have things like, you know, Jasmine Guillory, who's wonderful. She wrote a book for Disney called By the Book. And of course, it's for Disney. So it's going to be what they call a closed door romance, which is what you think of as in a movie where, you know, oh, the fire is roaring and the wind is at the window and the door is closed and we're not actually going to see what happens.
Oh my God. So romance novels for evangelical Christians, I guess, right?
Which is a thing, right? Like, that is absolutely a space. And I remain shocked whenever I see, you know, people read my book and then they follow me on Instagram and I'll see someone who's like, you know, Midwest mom, love Jesus, like whatever. And, you know, and they love my book. And I'm like, you know what? I've spent a lot of my life advocating for abortion and I'm thrilled to have you and I hope you enjoyed it.
Hey, like, absolutely.
Absolutely. Your next book is YA, or did I make that up?
You did make that up.
It's not. Okay, I made that up. But it's about vampires.
You're doing fiction too. it is. It's about vampires. It's called Fang Fiction, and it'll be out October 1st, which is also my birthday, which is wild.
A week before my birthday.
Oh, look at us, Libras.
Look at us,
no
Libras.
Wonder we're so pretty.
I want to go back for just a second. You were talking about the horror of your parents reading your romance novels. Oh, my mom very recently was like, you know, we're 282 episodes into this podcast. And she's like, I want to start listening to your podcast.
Oh, no.
And I was like, you can't. thankfully, they don't know how to download them. And they still call them websites sometimes. She's like, I want to listen to your website. I'm like, it's a podcast. But I actually started the process where I was like, I don't want to exclude her. So I'm like, maybe I will listen back to certain episodes and edit them. Edit them so my mom doesn't have to hear me talk about how slutty Elliot is.
My mom.
It's all about Elliot. That's the bottom line.
My
somehow.
Mom definitely listens. She definitely listens and she enjoys.
And we love that. And we support her 110%.
Now, so wait, Kate. So I would like to talk more about The Bachelor, but we have a limited amount of time. You are a Bachelor fanatic and it's fascinating to me because you've been helpful in helping me understand like what it is. I still don't fully wrap my head around like why it exists, meaning like the artifice of it is so baffling to me.
Yes.
But do you, how do you, why do you love it so much?
Well, and I will say full disclosure that sort of after One to Watch came out and I was basically, you know, promoting the book and talking nonstop about The Bachelor after having written about a fake version of The Bachelor for about 4 years straight, I was like, I may be done with this show. So I haven't watched it in several years. But the thing that I actually loved about it at the time was the opposite of what you just said, actually, was the non-artifice of it, was sort of like at the heart of like these stupid fake dates and these obvious reality TV gimmicks. And this one is the villain and that one is the, and like, it's all so fucking fake. And despite all of that, these people are like really falling in love on TV and you're watching it happen. Some of them are, you know, Ryan and Trista are still together. Bless their hearts.
You love The Golden Bachelor.
No, I haven't watched that one, but people love that one.
Yeah.
I see.
I always thought The Bachelor and Bachelorette were just sort of like Drag Race for straight people. I mean, it was just, it feels like the only thing that they discuss. And when it happens, when it starts, when the conversation, also Vanderpump Rules too, I feel like straight people love. And it just, when the conversation...
I do still love Vanderpump Rules. I am prepared to talk about Scandoval as...
When the conversation starts, I'm immediately like, okay, I'll go back to RuPaul. You have this. You have this.
I feel like Vanderpump Rules crosses
I'm sure
lines.
There are homosexuals who love Vanderpump Rules. I just find that the same type of people who obsessively talk about The Bachelor and The Bachelorette are also talking about Vanderpump Rules and not The Housewives in the way I talk about The Housewives. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's fair.
I'm just saying. Maybe I'm a super faggot. I don't know.
I mean, why choose?
Why choose? It's just me. I'm just gonna be me.
The other big, at least a significant part of you in my life is that you were the first person to really lay out for me the queer lady conspiracy theories around because you're a huge
I knew this
Taylor
is where
Smith
we were going.
And it was the first time that I'd been really like given insight into this dialogue that was happening around Taylor. And we've since had Jill Gudowitz, who's an incredible writer on the show. Yeah. And she really laid out the sort of conspiracy theories around Taylor too, which obviously have been, I guess, dispelled by Team Taylor by now. But all that being said, explain the in your Taylor
explain
Swift
the Jodie Foster
discourse.
Golden Globe speech of Taylor Swift. That's exact.
That is a beautiful comparison.
Yeah, tell me what speech? Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know.
Then. So the Golden Globes a couple years ago, Jodie Foster was one of the youngest winners of the Lifetime Achievement Awards at the Golden Globes because she's been around forever and she is queen lesbian. Anyway. Everyone knew she was lesbian, but she had never really publicly come out. And then she gave this speech where she basically was sort of being like, and I love my friend, partner, best friend, person.
It was a very, I actually just watched it again recently, and it's very, it's actually uncomfortable. Yeah, it's really weird.
So she came out and didn't come out, but that's the speech. Anyway, I'm sorry, Kate.
Yeah.
And it has been really nice this award season to see her just out with her wife on the carpet, doing the circuit and like playing an out lesbian in NIAID and being nominated for that work. And I'll just say one of my best friends wrote that movie. So I'm just a huge Team NIAID cheerleader.
Well, you should
so
listen
that's
to
been
my
really
interview
great.
With both Jodie Foster and Annette Bening.
My goodness. I heard you talking about the little clip that you played on the podcast. Yeah. And I was texting. I was like, Julia Allen said such nice things about NIAID.
I'm a big supporter of it. It's such a wonderful, wonderful movie.
Oh, that's so great. I totally agree. So if you're a person who believes that Taylor Swift is gay and you participate in that fandom on the internet, and I will say I'm saying gay meaning queer, right? Some version of queer. That's called a gayler. And it's now become a very mainstream thing. In the year of our Lord 2014, when my friend Kyria and I listened to 1989 and were like, is it us or is this shit really gay? It was not a mainstream thing. At that time, if you wanted to be involved in gayler conspiracy theories, you had to go to Tumblr. Tumblr was the only place for you. It was the only place for me. So that happened in 2014. Then 2015, I go to work for Hillary. I'm, you know, sort of not engaging with pop culture in any meaningful way. 2017, I come back. I had this horrible experience of like a really bad pile on Twitter. I had like posted some nice photos of my friends from the campaign. And I don't know why that it made the internet very angry. And so a lot of people were like, oh, you should kill yourself. And I was like, I'm going to get off Twitter. And I was like, you know what I'm going to do is wholesale replace this with gay Taylor Swift conspiracy Tumblr. And I have never made a better decision for my mental health in my entire life. And that was during the Reputation era, which is my favorite era. And also, I would argue, the most sort of overtly gay era, which is saying something because in, you know, the lead video for Lover, she is like literally leading a pride parade.
Yeah. Isn't that the era where Gayle King was in leather in the music video? Wasn't that era?
Everyone was in leather in those music videos.
Yeah, but Gayle King was the most important person in leather in that music video. So, which I'm interviewing Gayle King tomorrow morning and I will ask her about that. Thank you.
So, back at that time, I will say it felt a little bit, it was more fun. And it was a lot about like, what are the secret meanings in the lyrics and what are the hints she's dropping for us? And now that she's become this sort of unrivaled global superstar where everyone is sort of grasping for pieces of her, it, you know, she was very big in 2017, 2018, kind of when I was on Tumblr talking and writing an embarrassing amount about this. But now it's sort of, it feels kind of gross now in a way that it didn't then.
Well, I don't know. I'm not a Swiftie at all. I can say that pretty proudly, but I will say that
that's nothing to be proud
about. I know. But when I see Taylor and who's the ketchup guy?
Travis Kelce.
Yeah. I always think ketchup when I hear his name. But when they kiss and when she is being lovey on him, it does kind of scream office lesbian. It does. Yes, because the kiss.
This is a great take.
It seems so fake to me. It seems so. Travis just seems like, oh, I got this superstar. Where she's all like, I'm gonna run to the field and make this a thing. And it just feels like Deborah's trying really hard, and we know she lives with her roommate slash best friend. Like, and she's like really trying to sell this lady at the Christmas party, or this guy at the Christmas party. You know what I mean? Like, I don't.
Yeah, I do. And especially early on, like when he showed up at the, you know, the show in Argentina, and she was running to kiss him and changing the lyric. I felt like she's selling me something. Yes. And why? Yes. Why? Yeah. I don't need to be sold anything. Exactly. Right. And I hope, you know, she's a person who brings me a lot of joy. I hope she's so happy.
Yeah.
Right. And that's really the thing about it. I kind of hope the Travis stuff isn't fake, because it would make me so sad if it was fake. Like, and it's just like, I hope she's just super in love and super happy, and I hope that's great. And also, like, I don't know if you guys ever watched The Good Place, but there's this like scene where one of the characters, Tahani, is like walking down this hall, and behind each door people are talking about her, and like the test she has to pass is like, can she get to the end of the hallway without opening up the door to see what they're saying about her? And if she can get to the end of the hall, she's going to heaven. And if she can't get to the end of the hall, she's going to hell. And if one of those doors said the truth about Taylor Swift's sexuality, I would be fucking going to hell, because I would not be able to walk by. I just like, I just have to know.
You're going to hold on for dear life. Forever.
Yeah.
Just look at the Gayle King.
Kate Stamen London, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you on the internet? Where can they follow you and buy your books?
Oh my gosh. Well, anywhere books are sold, but obviously I encourage you to patronize your local independent bookstore. They are wonderful places. Go in, talk to your bookseller, make a friend. One to Watch is out now. Fang Fiction will be out in October. I am _KSL on Twitter, where I never post anymore, and _KSL on Instagram, which when I signed up for that handle, I was like, who's fucking _KSL? Like, who took it? And then like months later, I decided to check it, and it was a picture of my stepmother. It was me, and I had just forgotten that I had already. But anyway, it's 2 underscores.
That's so funny.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Kate.
Thank you. Have a great night, guys.
And another thing.
So if you guys were to open up a business, a small business, let's say, doing your part for the American dream, living your American dream, what would that small business look like to you? Brent?
Well, let's start with Elliot because I think he posed this question, and I'm still struggling to figure out like my dream business.
Okay. Well, I can tell you, the reason I thought of this question was because recently I was uncling to my 2.5-year-old niece while she was in LA with the family.
I relished
every minute of it, and you know she's 2.5, so. You know, the options are sort of limited. You know, she's not old enough to be doing fully, you know,
you can't
like
take her to the gay bars.
Things.
Yeah. You can't do the things that you would do. Yeah.
Right. But she's also not an infant who wants to go to a, like, who could like be in a stroller at a museum just sleeping. Right. So she's sort of at that perfect age where you're not quite sure what to do. And I found a place in LA that's, I forget the name of it, Easton Museum or something. It's something, a children's museum on the West Side. That's less of a museum and more somewhere between Discovery Zone and a museum for kids. It's somewhere in the middle where it's super physical and there's all these different elements like a kitchen area, a grocery store, this sort of like story time playpen. There's roped or netted like tubes that she was crawling through in the ceiling where she's basically she's in the air crawling through the air in netting, all these different elements, some digital, a lot of analog. And it was so cool and so fun for her because it was geared towards engagement and you know, stimulation, but it wasn't stupid, but it also wasn't heavy-handed in the way that it was educational. And I thought, man, not only do I want to get up in those nets and crawl through, but I was like, it would be cool to open a business where I combined this with the adult version of that. So like I like indoor rock climbing sometimes. The idea of getting to do that while my kid or whomever gets to do their thing, and there's a bar. You know, maybe there's video games of some kind, or maybe there aren't.
There's a bar.
which is
fine for Elliot and Alan and I, but like if you put a bar around parents, that means there's going to be a fight.
Yeah.
In almost any other setting outside of like meek gay men, there's going to be fighting involved. So we can omit the bar. I think Elliot was just trying to get me excited.
Yeah.
I think it could be a cool, there's a place here in LA downtown called, Two Bit Circus. And it's like a sort of weirdly non-corporate arcade for adults and some kids where they do escape rooms, but all these video games that are like not super corporate arcade games. They're more like stuff you'd see by indie developers or whatever. And there's a bar and there's escape rooms and some physical stuff. And I'm like, it would be so cool to do a combo, you know, where it's like kid friendly and there's drinks and there's immersive stuff and there's technology. I don't know what that is. I guess it's sort of like an indoor fun zone, but
there is
a cool business.
There's what's called the Hands-On Museum in my hometown of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And it is really a phenomenal space. It's kind of what you're describing, sans bar. But yeah, you know, it's like $30. It's like a museum and there's, I mean, literally hundreds of like science displays that are, of
is
course,
it for
you know,
kids or adults or
for kids. It's all for kids.
You
know, I remember going when I was a kid and, you know, it was just such a cool place, to kind of explore. They have like holograms. There's like this one room where you can like watch a video and it's like a hologram. It's very strange, but it's really cool. There's another thing where you can walk up this small ladder and you're facing what looks to be sort of like a satellite dish and you talk into it. And there's another satellite dish across the room, maybe 30 feet away. And it just, you know, it's trying to kind of showcase how sound waves travel.
Yeah.
And they can be kind of corralled for a certain viewer. And you can have a whisper conversation with a friend who's at, you know, 30 feet away by speaking into this like huge satellite dish that's facing in the other direction as your friend.
So these like science centers are like so cool for kids. And I still have fond memories, except for the one where we saw an IMAX movie and they were like warning us that it might be a lot to take in. And I threw up from anxiety just thinking about seeing an IMAX movie.
Just from thinking about it?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
No, the risks seem outrageous.
I'm the opposite in that, like, when I was a kid, I hated places like that because I was just like, I just want, like, to sit and watch TV. Like, I don't need all of this shit. You know what I mean? And it just felt like I had to force, like, I was forced to play with idiots. And it just felt, it literally just felt like
idiots. You mean your brothers? Yes, what you constantly call them idiots? Yeah.
But also just other kids, because they're all just fucking dumb.
I can so see you as a kid calling other kids idiots. Yeah. These idiots that I have
to have a Jodie Foster movie to go watch. which is not a lie. I literally, in my interview, I told Jodie Foster how my mom took me out of school to see Home for the Holidays when I was like, 11 years old, because I had to.
Oh my God.
And she wasn't even in the movie. She directed it. That's how much of a fan I was.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. No, if I had to open a bit, I mean, I respect anyone who opens up a small business because like it is not an easy thing. And like that ambition is not a thing that I have. But if I were to open up a small business, I kept thinking like what I would love and what would be fun. And like two of the things I love is like pop culture, Hollywood nostalgia, of course. Like I love that element, but I also love like scents, like candles and perfumes and like things like that. So I feel like I would probably, and this sounds so gross, but I would probably do like candles and perfumes and stuff that are like, that give off the
inspired.
No, well, no, not that, but give off the, well, I guess inspired. Did you say expired or inspire?
Inspired.
Oh, I just said expire. I was like, no, they don't have an expiration date. These careers are forever. No, that inspire sort of like the scent of what
the essence
of what like Blanche on the Golden Girls would smell like, or what, like, you know what I mean? Like I would give off that
smart idea.
The jeans smart.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I feel like that would be a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
It would
fun.
Be a copyright nightmare, but it would be a fun thing to do.
Certainly would. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Brent, I'm assuming we're gonna talk about a massage studio where you choose the clients and you pay them. Massage by Brent. I choose you. I pay you.
Good Lord. So I couldn't think of anything. I will say, sort of touching upon this, every time I meet someone who has an Etsy page, I become wildly jealous because it's always sounded like such a fun, easy thing. If you had like the easiest, the simplest would be like if you're a calligrapher, you know, there are like calligraphers on Etsy, obviously for weddings or, you know, wedding invitations or whatever. And I would just, oh my God, I would love it. Like waking up in the morning being like, you know, checking your email. Three orders and you got to go write some bitch's name on like a note card and then you ship it off. You made $40. It just sounds so fun.
Some bitch's name who paid you to send her a product. No, who paid you.
It's true. It's a great connection.
This bitch.
I think.
Thanks for the order, bitch.
I think there should be I feel like you should do like an, what are those stores called? Like preparedness stores? Like survival stores?
Survival is actually one around the corner from me.
Yeah, I can. You have like there's like bear spray, Narcan, like you know, high grade like condoms.
You know what's all right. So this is all right. I will tell you. I just remembered this. I oddly sort of similar piggybacking on what you've described, Elliot. I have always wanted to open up an adult adventure center but like fill it full of things that people always think about, like what's that like, but then never get the chance to try it.
You're going to think
this one's crazy, but like one, this is the dumbest example. They would normally be fun, but like, you know, like when you do indoor skydiving, like that one, like I think it would have like one of those. But for me, I'm not kidding. I always, when I lived in New York, there were always these awful stories about people who would jump down onto the train track to get like their cell phone that they had dropped, and then they couldn't get back up in time, and then they would get hit by the train. So I was like, I would set up, Brent, like an actual track where like a train is like a video train is coming and you have to jump down onto the train track to get your cell phone, and you'll see how easy or hard it is to get back up.
That is how fun.
That is so dark.
Brent's, so we're talking an immersive experience, but all the experiences are going to have to be based around sudden death.
No, guillotines.
Yeah. His other room is a plane crashing.
another one is an execution line. Historical execution line. It's like Brent's Ripley's Believe It or Not, but like everyone leaves shaking in fear, trembling in fear.
What would your aunt say?
Brent, what would your Aunt Ramona say about something she heard on today's show?
I've been waiting 282 episodes and I finally get my Jennifer Weiner shout out.
My Aunt Joanne would say, I would watch The Bachelor if it was Jewish. Has there ever been a Jewish Bachelorette or Bachelor?
I'm sure there has, right? But I don't know.
I mean, I'm sure the production team has some Jewish folks.
Oh, wow. Friend. Wow. What about Aunt Anne?
Aunt Anne would say, I have a great small business idea. Whenever you make little treats at home, I'll come and I'll taste them to see if they're good or not. I'll be a taste tester for little treats.
That's like actually a great idea.
Yeah. Have treats, will travel.
That's right. Well, everyone, join our Patreon. You're Making It Worse at patreon.com. And thank you for listening. Good night and good luck.